thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about a common research project that I'm doing with Nadine Levrateau on international similarities of bank lending practices and varieties on insolvency laws. The motivation, well, we've been motivated by the varieties of capitalism approach that seeks to explain varieties of capitalism by existing varieties and complementarities between institutional structures and the behavior of firms as the main lenders. And in following this line of thought, we have a focus on complementarities between the insolvency law and lending practices. And in doing so, we try to find answers to basically two questions. What are the implications for the role of collateral? And what are the implications for the relative importance of arm's length as opposed to relational lending? We have a focus on France and Germany, not only because we come from these two countries, but the insolvency laws in both countries are very different. Now, our point of departure are two complement hypotheses proposed by economic theory, more specifically game theory. According to the first complement hypothesis, there exists a complementarity between the degree of priority of secured lenders in formal proceedings and the use of collateral, in particular in bank loans. And there exists a second complementarity between a priority of inside collateral. These are assets whose value correlate with firm value and relational lending. The objective of our contribution, we seek to find out whether France and Germany represent examples for the empirical validity of both complement hypotheses. Well, I start very briefly with the insolvency laws in France and Germany, just with a focus on the topic that we have. Then I'd like to present also very briefly the two complement hypotheses and the evidence. I conclude and say one sentence about future research. Okay. Well, there are commonalities between the French and the German insolvency law concerning, first, the maximization of the insolvent firm's estate as a primary objective. Second, with respect to the equal treatment of creditors as a fundamental principle, and also with respect to existing exceptions to these rules. However, how point one and point three are really realized, this is very different in the French and the German insolvency law. Now, the French case is, as I learned from Nadine, a menu of possible solutions. There is a huge number of amendments since the introduction of the Commerce Code in 1807, and the present institutional structure is significantly shaped by four different laws since 1994. Now, you may ask the question, why have there been so many enactments? Well, the primary goal of the French insolvency law, or we can also say the conviction of the legislators, is that the maximization of the borrower's estate is best guaranteed by reorganizing the firm. However, reality has deviated from this theoretical objective, or from this objective, objective never theoretical, it's an objective, very significantly, and all the enactments, the reforms, have to be understood from this background. Now, what is most important for our topic is that in trying to maximize the borrower's estate by reorganizing the firm, collateralization of loans by itself has never determined the ranking or the rank of creditors. But it is, at least since 2005, the personal or the contribution of a creditor to the reorganization of firm, specifically in the form of fresh money that has to be provided in order to improve one's rank. On the contrary, the German insolvency law, which has a tradition for liquidation in the 19th century, the Konkursordnung that ruled until 1999 was enacted in 1878, and at that time, liquidation was thought to be the best way to maximize market efficiency. And the law was very stable, was considered to be the jewel of the German legislation, and so we only had one enactment in 1935 in the wake of the economic crisis when a huge number of firms was liquidated, and this enactment or reform came in the form of a composition code, the Vergleichsordnung. But what is important is the fact that secured lenders had absolute priority concerning all types of collateral and concerning also what they could do during the official or formal proceedings. So there was the right to exemption. This concerned collateral in possession of the creditors, and these assets never belonged to the borrower's estate as such, and the right to separation that gave creditors the right to liquidate their assets quite separately from what was going on in the formal bankruptcy or insolvency proceedings. There was a growing dissatisfaction with this law, in particular in the 1970s. So as you may see here, 3/4 of all petitions were turned down due to a lack of estate. Unsecured lenders did not recover more than 3 to 5%, and hardly ever was a firm reorganized, at least not in the formal proceedings. So we got a new insolvency law in 1999, and the objectives were quite clear cut. First, to increase the firm's or the insolvent firm's estate, basically by giving the debtor the right to file for formal bankruptcy already when insolvency was not a fact yet, but it was impending, by deferment of procedural costs and by a partial cutback, I come back to that point, on secured lenders' rights to separation. And of course, Germany also moved towards a little bit more reorganization by allowing debtors and creditors to agree on an insolvency plan procedure. However, qualifications are in order here, because nothing goes without the approval of secured lenders. I can summarize this slide by this. Secured lenders have to improve, in particular to the question whether the firm should be reorganized or not. And whenever they experience a cutback in their rights, they receive compensation, for example, in the form that they are allowed to collateralize up to 110%. So in sum, when I talk to lawyers, they assured me nothing much has changed so far. We have to do more about this law. Now I come to the complementarity hypothesis. One, stating a complementarity between the seniority of secured lenders and the collateralization of bank loans. Well, the insolvency law, in fact, decides on the extent to which secured lenders can assign an insurance function to the collateralization of their debt. But this is not a sufficient condition for lenders to really collateralize debt, because as any insurance, it has its cost. Costs are incurred in the selection of collateral, in monitoring its value, as well as in enforcing collateral. And finally, the borrower has to be compensated, which usually comes in the form of a low interest rate. So we may say all this cost has to be compensated by benefits. Now, economic theory says that if we have a closer look at these benefits, they go beyond a pure insurance function, because there are also ex-ante effects which reduce the probability of default by avoiding adverse selection, by avoiding moral hazard, and by avoiding strategic insolvency. So there are quite a lot of benefits. And according to an article published in 1997 by Welsh, banks are the principal secured lenders because they have a higher capability than other lenders in reducing the cost of collateralization due to their organizational advantages. But banks also enjoy comparatively higher benefits because they are the main lenders to small and medium-sized firms. And there is a great literature in economics that this group of firms is in particular opaque, thus the risk, or there are in particularly high risks of adverse selection, moral hazard, and strategic insolvency involved. So we can conclude that given a high priority, because this is of course necessary for borrowers to behave well, otherwise if they have to accept that the loss of collateral in case of misbehavior is a binding constraint, of course. And so we may conclude that the extensive use of collateral by banks should be typical for financial systems with an insolvency law which assigns a high priority to secured lenders. And in fact, this can be confirmed for Germany under the Konkursordnung. 3/5 of the insolvent firm's assets were secured with banks holding 70% of all rights of separation and exemption. 81% of their claims were collateralized. So far, concerning the new insolvency law, we do not have such a comprehensive study. There exists a study by Kranzusch, and he was interested in particular in the recovery rates of unsecured lenders, and according to this study, it has remained below 5%. So it still is not more than 5%. And so with caution, we may conclude that indeed nothing much has changed so far. Now, coming to France, the situation is a bit different, as we have heard, concerning the insolvency law. But concerning collateral, it's not that different, because collateralization in France is high too. But this is not a consequence of the insolvency law. It can't be a consequence of the insolvency law. This is a consequence of an institution, we may say a complementary institution, that came into existence because small and medium-sized firms, and this might have been a consequence of the insolvency law, were exposed to credit rationing. And you know, in order to overcome this credit rationing, an institution called OSIO was put into existence, and this institution guarantees or offers banks a guarantee to their loans. This institution by itself can claim collateralization from the small and medium-sized firms, but in sum, what banks achieve through this OSIO is that 74% of their bank loans can be guaranteed, and indirectly collateralized, though OSIO assumes or has assumed this job. And so collateralization, this is the basic conclusion, is significant in both countries too. In France, a complementary institution has come into existence that tries to avoid or to reduce the detrimental effects of a missing priority of secured lenders. Now, coming to the complementary between the seniority of banks and relationship lending. Now the argument relies very much on the type of collateral, namely on inside collateral, as I said, assets whose value is correlated with the value of the firm. And economic theory, also in Bayesian game theoretic approaches, finds that priority for inside collateral has explanatory power for relational lending. And these arguments are based basically four major properties of relational lending. First, of course, the intensive exchange of information reduces information asymmetry greatly. Second, typical of a relationship, credit relationship, is an incomplete contract with respect to future states of return, so renegotiation is necessary and typical. And in a functioning relationship, renegotiation is not used for opportunistic behavior, hold up in this respect, but for the maximization of the mutual expected benefit. And importantly, relational lending is not identical with exclusive lending. It is compatible with multiple lending. So what is special about inside collateral? Whereas we have talked some minutes ago about the benefits of collateral being that the behavior of debtors is affected to the advantage of the creditor. It is now the behavior of creditors that is affected. First of all, inside collateral serves to determine priority of the lender over future cash flows, and so the lender might have an incentive to monitor the firms in order to make out the value of its collateral. Second, the lender might have an incentive to offer financial support in distress situations because he can find out whether the borrower will use the additional funds for risk shifting or for retaining the quality of the original project, and the borrower in return, knowing this, will have no incentive to risk shifting. This is one of the messages of the Langhofer-Santos model. And lastly, inside collateral may set incentives to even acquire some management know-hows, because if the creditor thinks about overtaking the firm in a situation of insolvency, he may be better able to maximize the firm's assets if he knows how to do it. Now, the German system indeed is associated with relational lending, and there exists a study by Elsass Kranen, 2002, who state that they have found evidence indeed for a positive correlation between inside collateral, the priority of inside collateral, which exists in Germany, of course, and both relationship lending, but also informal workouts. Whereas in France, at least since the 1990s, the financial system can be characterized by a predominance of arm's length lending. And the major reason for this result is a heavy withdrawal of the state, as well as the coming or the growing engagement of Anglo-Saxon investors. Now, looking at the structure of collateral, the evidence shows that indeed inside collateral is very weakly used, whereas there is a predominance of outside collateral. And so the question here arises whether indeed we can confirm the second complement hypothesis. A word of caution is in order here. Let's have a more critical look at the German evidence. Now, if I looked at the descriptive statistics of the Elsass-Kranen model, what struck me right away is that in their model or in their approach, arm's length banks also take inside collateral. And I don't think that the difference between 40% versus 41.6% is significantly high in this respect. Furthermore, it appears very different in empirical studies to distinguish between inside and outside collateral. For example, Elsass-Kranen, they use real estate, but if you have a look at small, and in particular smaller firms, real estate can be anything. It can also be the personal, the house of the family. And finally, in their correlation, they do not distinguish between inside and outside collateral at all. And so I may conclude that indeed empirical evidence, convincing evidence for this hypothesis is still missing. And also recalling that theory says that inside collateral has explanatory power for relational lending, and having a look at the French evidence, we might also reverse the line of causation, saying since French banks do not have an interest in establishing a close relationship, they are not interested in taking inside collateral at all. And so we think that complement hypothesis 2 cannot be confirmed for both countries, and that in particular with respect to the explanation why we have arm's length and relational length lending, we are in need of further arguments lying outside the insolvency law. So to conclude, we conclude that the degree of priority appears to be less important for the role of collateral in bank debt than stated by economic theory, and in particular, we cannot confirm a dominant role of priority for inside collateral in explaining relational lending. Thus, we conclude that this moderates the role of the insolvency law for the shaping of lending practices. Concerning the last point, relational versus arm's length lending, we seek to take other approaches into account, and we found a very interesting approach resorting to cultural value orientations. Thank you very much.
I have a couple of informational questions. I find the distinction between inside and outside collateral confusing. Real estate, is that outside or inside?
Exactly.
We don't know.
We don't know.
So there's a literature that talks about inside and outside, and we don't know what the distinction is?
That's
okay.
Right.
What's the line between arm's length and relational lending? Is relational lending a house bank that has a long, that is just there for many years until we get into difficulty?
Yes.
And how is that different from another bank relationship or another bank loan? It's just duration?
No, it's not duration. There is a very, very long literature concerning the house bank principle or relational lending. And the first contributions, they had a focus on duration. But then we had a lot of theoretical models, and these set of theoretical models put other arguments to the foreground, and that is the incompleteness of the contract. So that the bank and the debtor, they conclude contracts or they conclude an initial contract that has some gaps, because they very loosely plan that the contract should last longer, but it need not be a formally long contract. And so it is not long-run debt that is crucial for relationship lending. It is the factual duration of the relationship, the factual duration. So going back to history, so in the 19th century, German banks never lent long, but they lent repeatedly to one and the same borrower. So they really were sticking together.
This is my last question. I take it the German system of what you're calling absolute priority, the American meaning is different, works because the bank, when default occurs, will look at the value of the collateral and decide whether to take it or whether there's more value by leaving it in the business and permitting a reorganization. And the system works because it gives the bank the choice as between liquidation and continuance.
Yes, yes. That's exactly the case in Germany.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to follow up on this. It seems to me that from a theoretical standpoint, I'd like to think of relational lending as lending to a client with whom you have other banking relations, especially if you clear their checks. So you have not only control of their cash flow, but you have day-to-day information about how much cash is coming in and how much cash is going out. And that informational advantage
is tremendous.
You know,
yes.
And that's a straightforward, at least the way I think about it, distinction or definition of insider lending or insider relationships, which would make sense in this case.
Yes, so a relational bank...
It will have nothing to do with duration. It will have...
Yeah, it has to do with that, but in fact, the number of house banks, the average number of house banks of a German small and medium-sized firm is 4 to 6. So they do not have only a single house bank, but still, this is what at least economic theory also says, that there are considerable economies of scope for a house bank, because the data set is very comprehensive, of course, yes. Yeah, and control, yes.
And I wonder if it's fair to say that in some ways the German and the French system are becoming a little more similar to each other, and maybe also more similar to the American system. So you've got now ways to avoid the priority system of the French regime and make it more like absolute priority of secured lenders. And it also sounds to me like there's... an emphasis, one of the other things that always people say about the American versus, let's say, the Brits or the Europeans is that we have more organizations and they have more liquidation and that, and therefore the management and the debtor in possession has more power. And it sounds to me like even that, with the new German legislation and maybe moving away from the liquidation model, a little bit. So do you think that's right?
Yeah, what we have always discussed, but it's very difficult to find empirical evidence for this, that there's always been a considerable number of informal workouts. So between the house bank and the insolvent firm. And whether now these informal workouts will be transformed into official workouts, namely reorganization, this is an open question. So even if you ask lawyers, and we had a very interesting talk, Nadine and me, with a professor of law coming from Munich, who wrote his habilitation thesis on reorganization between market and the law, he was not quite sure.
In the statistics in the paper, it's aggregate statistics for both France and Germany, which means small businesses and large corporations.
Yeah.
To what extent in practice, if it's a very large firm, will the institutional mechanisms work differently? That is, I wouldn't see liquidation of a very large firm being something you would see in the ordinary course.
This is why we have focused on small and medium-sized firms, and you are right. If we're talking about large firms, I think there are great similarities between the countries because the externalities are just too high to liquidate a large firm. But what we have also learned on a recent workshop in Paris is that in particular large firms, they practice forum shopping in the European Union. You know, they just pick out the insolvency law which they like, and so this is the problem that we have now.
Where do they go?
Well, it depends.
It depends on the purpose of the location.
Yes, and we even have it with consumers because in Germany we have this the discharge of the final debt, but the consumer has to wait for 6 years. In France, only for 6 months. And so, so what we have learned is that there have developed some special organizations helping German insolvent households to really go insolvent in France. They go to France.
Is it preferred by multinationals?
Yes, this is a question around the center of main interest of the firm. There is a strong debate. Where
is the center,
the core of the firm?
Yeah.
Is it in England? Is it in France or in Dutchland? And according to the answers of this question, you have to apply either English, German, or French law. But lawyers produce a lot of doctrine about this question because of this forum shopping.
So is it Luxembourg, or is there any general preference that
I think it won't be England. It won't be the UK because the UK is extremely creditor friendly.
Quickly, the best place is France because you have this liquidation possibilities that allows you to close a plant or a factory in 3 or 4 months, benefiting from an insurance on the wages that is a public system that allows a firm to fire workers without paying anything to the workers.
So is there any evidence of these four jurisdictions trying to compete on this as well?
I don't know.
At the moment, no.
Oh, I was just wondering if there's any evidence of industry effects because, you know, U.S., virtually every airline is either in bankruptcy or bound through bankruptcy in the past versus every financial institution almost either there's two choices, you either you liquidate or you're taken over by somebody else. Mm. So you almost never go through a reorganization, a financial institution.
Yes,
the
airline industry, automotive industry, developed a strategic use of insolvency law. And it is really difficult to bring evidence about this use because thanks to corporation group of firms, the parent company can cut all the expenses towards the subsidiary, and the assets of the subsidiary collapse. There is nothing to rescue, and now you can downsize a group very easily without any cost, just using the liquidation possibility. And the airlines and the automotive industry are very good for that.
Mm. And concerning financial institutions, there's always state involvement due to externalities.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not actually very clear about the distinction, the boundary line between liquidation and reorganization. Is Lehman Brothers liquidated or reorganized?
Yeah, it's only very clear.
It's liquidated and pieces are sold off.
Yeah.
Pieces are sold off, and whatever else is a liquidation, whatever's left is a liquidation.
So, isn't it?
I would call it, it's a liquidation.
It doesn't exist anymore, it's part of practice.
I would say it's a liquidation.
Well, actually, there's employees there that are going to be there for the rest of their lives.
But
maybe.
But notice the fact that we have sales means that going concerns survive.
Yeah, exactly. So that distinction isn't as clear as sometimes we have to be.
Yes, that's right.
Banking insolvency law is different of corporate insolvency law. So you cannot make a merge between the two bodies of this insolvency law. It's easier for corporate because there is not the principle not so well set up, too big to fail. Of course, in some sense, you can consider that very big corporations are not liquidated, but the too big to fail principle is still very vivid in banking insolvency law and less evident as it has been proved by Kaufman, Kaufman, bankruptcy.
Common bankruptcy. But an extreme form of liquidation would be to sell all the assets as assets so that
nuts
nothing of the firm remains. And this, of course.
It's a sample of nuts and bones.
Yes.
And
but
fire
at this.
Sale.
Yeah, fire sale. Yeah.
Thank you very much.